Can Sandy tell me what is the relation between pop music and folk music?
That's an interesting question, and one which I think the complete answer to it probably hasn't been found. But I think that I did mention that, for example, that Buddy Holly thought that the rock and roll music he was playing was really country music with drums, as he put it. Now, clearly there's a relationship, because one of the inspirations for rock and roll, and one of the things which has fed it anyway, which has fed modern rock music, is the blues. And if the blues isn't folk music, then frankly I don't know what it is. There's a rather amusing story told about that. A black blues singer was being recorded, I think, by some folks on Collector, or he was heard by somebody who was interested in this sort of thing, and the guy asked him, was it folk music he was singing? And his reply was, well, it sure ain't no horse singing, man. So, you know, that rather sums that up, I think. But the pop music could be said, in some of its aspects, to be rather similar to folk music. I mean, it's written quite often by ordinary people, but the trouble with pop music is that there is a essentially commercial element about it. I mean, once somebody has, you know, once you've written a song, it's sort of taken over, as it were. Now, clearly, in the days in which folk songs were largely composed, there were people, for example, who went around singing for their living. So it was monetary in that respect, or indeed possibly not monetary. Possibly they sang for their supper, literally. There were fiddlers and harpers and minstrels of various kinds who did travel around and who made their living, or part of their living, from singing. But there wasn't the same commercialism involved in that. There was perhaps in the broadside ballads, which were ballads which, about the time of the invention of printing, I think certainly since the beginning or the middle of the 16th century, these ballads would be put out to comment on events. They would be sort of like news sheets, almost. A printer would just get one out, and, you know, hundreds of copies would be printed and sold around the streets. So that was commercial in one sense. But I think that pop music differs from folk music in that there is this highly commercialised aspect to it, and it's quite a technological music, really, isn't it? I mean, you can sit in your back room with an electric guitar and a sort of amplifier that fell off the back of a lorry and probably suffered a few fractures in the process and perform that way. But the actual, what counts as pop music, what people know as pop music, is the highly produced, recorded stuff. And I'm not knocking that, incidentally. I'm simply saying that it is a different form of music. But there is certainly some sort of relationship of descendants, if you like. Only partly, though, I should add.
To what extent would you say that pop music represents all that is horrible, all that is warlike and vicious in society? And what contribution, if that is so, what contribution does it play towards creating a socialist world?
Well, I don't agree with the assumption in your question. I suppose that might have something to do with the difference in age between us, but I actually think that, I mean, I like pop music. I don't want to keep giving my own opinions here, but I'm sure I'm speaking for quite a few people in this room when there's quite a lot of rock music or pop music, or whatever you like to call it, that we like, that quite a few of us in this room like. The Beatles, for example, in my view, were certainly a notable phenomenon, to put it mildly. I think when people make these sort of comments, what they're often talking about is just the sheer noise of the thing. To them, it's such a very noisy form of music, and it represents all that is abrasive and sort of rat race-ish, if you like, in modern society. As for the contribution it can make to socialism, well, it's as simple as this. If there were good socialist pop songs, you know, it could make some contribution. Could, I think, being the operative word. There's no guarantee that it would do anything. I mean, we socialists engage in various activities, propaganda meetings, like education classes like this, you know, outdoor speaking, selling literature. And pop music is one of the activities, music in general, indeed, is one of the activities which could help us. And if there were some genius who could write us some good socialist pop songs, and incidentally, they're not entirely lacking. But if there were somebody who could do that, or one of, indeed it needs more than one person, it needs a whole band of us. And I think what I said about folk music applies just as well to pop music, what I said at the end of the talk there. If we get out and do it, and you know, yours truly included, that is where the fruits, if any, will show. If it's written well, if it's performed well, then it stands a good chance of having some effect. Now look at the Red Wedge thing. Now that's not socialist as we would understand it, but that is having a fair degree of success. Billy Bragg, despite the fact that some of us wonder whether he can sing or not, I'm being cruel actually. I've been too unkind to him. He's not too bad at times. I just don't like his version of the Diggers song. But you know, he has definitely managed to popularize to some extent a political cause, albeit it's something as puny as the re-election of a Labour government. Now, you know, we could have a go at doing that. We possibly wouldn't have as much immediate success as he did, of course, because we wouldn't have all the machinery behind us that he would.
I like to hear your views about how, with certain of the, you know, the great tensions that commercial society produces, released in a classical society, how you foresee, you know, that sort of art developing, folk music developing under those conditions?
Well, I think clearly, I think as socialists, we don't want to draw too many barriers. I think the one thing is worth saying here that, I mean, I've indicated to some extent, I think, in the talk that as far as folk music is concerned, I don't want to take too precious an attitude towards it. You know, as I indicated, there are people who have this view of the tradition and how you mustn't sort of spoil it. It must always be in its original state, so to speak. And I've pointed out that is, in fact, an anti-traditional view, in a sense, because the thing about folk music was that it developed, it changed, and, you know, possibly to some, you got an impression of that to some extent, the different kinds of tunes even, just taking it from that point of view, that existed in different areas and at different times. But clearly there are areas of music, and to some extent, as you say, that these are produced by conflicts in society. The differences are produced by there being different groups in society and the conflicts in these groups. But in fact, the folk revival itself has, in a sense of necessity, showed the way to some extent, I think, in this. For example, I had intended to include this somewhere in the talk, but I'll include it here. I think it's fairly relevant. What would you say this is? On first hearing, if you didn't know anything about the background of that, how would you classify that? That was the Fairport Convention, who were a group who originated as a sort of, I think they did American country music to some extent, they were certainly a sort of pop group to start with, but they started to do folk music, and they did it with electric instruments, with bass, drums, electric guitar and all the rest of it, as well as acoustic instruments. I mean, you had a fiddle in there, good old Dave Swarbrick, who is one of the best fiddle players in this country, I think. And unfortunately, you also have the voice of the late Sandy Denny, who was one of the better singers in the folk scene, indeed on the music scene in general, I think. But the folk revival, it's been done, I think, sometimes in a fairly self-conscious way in order to make traditional music sound interesting. But it has produced some very interesting results. I mean, I don't find it at all strange to hear, for example, trying to think of a name here, to hear a song like The False Knight on the Road, which isn't a very political song, it's actually a sort of religious allegory, done in the way that Steely Span did it, or even in the way that a group from Darkest Surrey, called Jump Leads, did it and were criticised very heavily for it. They were told it was the worst version of the song that the reviewer had ever heard. However, Jump Leads are a group who try to incorporate sort of various fairly ordinary rock music features and reggae features into their performance of folk music. They've often been criticised for a lack of professionalism in the actual performance of the songs, but nevertheless I've quite enjoyed listening to them, moderately enjoyed them anyway. And the folk revival has to some extent, as I say, pointed the road by having to incorporate, or by people getting into the business of incorporating different styles of music in the presentation of folk music. So that you can have anything from that excerpt from Jeannie Robertson, that very sort of artistically long drawn out sort of kind of unaccompanied singing. You can have anything from that to Clannad, you know, who, although they're fairly definitely Irish traditional, very sort of technological presentation of the music. And that can all count as folk music in one way or another. So, and indeed, rock music also has tried to go out in various directions. You know, it's been influenced by reggae and things like that. So music in modern society doesn't, although it is still classified and very, you know, people get very sort of conscious of the divisions and very property conscious about their type of music. And, for example, the Furies, who are basically an Irish group, when they were touring in Germany, they found that a lot of the German rock bands who they were touring with, in fact, did not, you know, they just didn't associate with them. They were very precious about their type of music, just as precious as some folkies can be about folk music. So clearly in a socialist society, a lot of this would be broken down, and I would see access to, because people's prejudices would, just to some extent anyway, go. I don't think that people will, all people will ever like everything, of course, but I think people would feel conscious that all the music of the past and all the potential music of the present and the future was their property, or was just as should be just as accessible to them. You know, on an equal basis, all the music as any other type of music. So I think that a more unified but diverse form of music might arise. You might still be able to say, oh, well, that's, you know, such and such a type of music, basically. But you wouldn't, I think, feel so, what's the word I'm looking for? You wouldn't feel so dogmatic about it. People wouldn't get so dogmatic about it, I think. That's really what I wanted to say.
Yeah,
I just wanted to say that on the point about pop music being warlike and vicious and so on, you want to listen to things like the 1812 Overture. most music actually is reflective national chauvinism.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing more horrible for a socialist than to have to sit listening to some of this stuff. I would say some of this big, loud, military sort of stuff knocked out by the so-called classical composers. I mean, these people are a lot of musical fascists, basically, if that's accepted. Yeah, the other thing I wanted to say was on the question of folk music. You know, a lot of people say, oh, we don't like listening to folk music because it's so bloody sad all the time. Well, the title of this talk explains why, because it's about workers' history. And workers' history is sad all the time. And it's all very well, Gary Glitcher and all these other, you know, Rob Stewart, all these other talentless, you know, twats coming out on stages telling us how happy we all are. And we have to very often pay for the privilege of being told how happy we are as well, incidentally. But the reality is that is not what working class history is like. I mean, I was just reminded when I thought of making that point of a friend of mine went along to the old Woolwich branch of the Socialist Party, which was years ago. And apparently they met down these old stone stairs in a sort of cellar somewhere, you see. And he went in and he talked to this member. He said, well, how come you meet in such a horrible, dingy building? And he said, because the working class are horrible and dingy. He's the best place to meet. I'm sure he didn't mean it entirely. But, you know, there's a certain element of truth in it. So you've got to face up to it. You know, it's like people say, we don't want to hear the bad news on the radio. You know, why can't we have radio stations which only tell us the good news? which of course they do have in Russia, but we just don't believe them, because it's Tony Blackburn on Radio London. So the thing is, folk music is a history of work, it's misery, you know, written in a the blood, sweat and tears of a working class, and that's why many people don't like it, just as many people are frightened of facing up to the political argument of socialism, because it's not that happy.
Just a few points to make on that. I don't want to get involved in an argument with Steve about Gary Glitter and Rod Stewart. Certainly not Rod Stewart anyway, because I quite like him. But I would say that some people don't like folk music because they think it's too happy. Actually, I mean there are songs. There are songs like. A song called Twanky Dillo, which sounds like a fairly ridiculous title for a song, but it's about the profession of a blacksmith, and one of the lines, I can't just remember now a sequence, one of the lines that goes something like, oh, it makes my bright hammer to rise and to fall. And incidentally, some of you may remember, those of you who are experts on Capital Volume 1, that Marx actually goes into this, but he has a rather ironic thing to say about the jolly blacksmith at one point in Capital. But some songs are like that, and indeed country people in the past would take to their hearts songs which painted an idyllic picture of their lives, you know, which clearly did not measure up to the reality, certainly not in all respects. Songs perhaps written by townspeople and rather upper class townspeople at that. It's worth bearing in mind that the pink cheeked milkmaids who are celebrated in quite a lot of songs might have been suffering from tuberculosis. Mm. That may have explained the colour of their faces. And a lot of songs about women in folk music, you know. Women are always fainting in folk songs, and you know, this is quite a serious point actually, that if you were a fairly unhealthy if as a country girl you had suffered quite a few of the diseases which modern medicine perhaps has done away with, and you know, any sort of emotional excitement might tend to make you faint away. Well, I mean, we won't go into that too much. But also, a lot of folk music, it's worth saying, is fairly warlike and violent. Indeed, I had intended to talk about one song of that description, which, of all the traditional ballads that I know, sums up the class struggle, if you like, that was going on in feudal society and brings it down to a personal level. It's a song, just to give you a brief description, it's a song about a stonemason who builds a castle for a feudal baron and is not paid for his work. And all the excuses are given, you know, I'm going over the sea, I can't pay you now, I'll have to sell my land if you want me to pay you, etc. All the sort of excuses which the lord obviously thought he'd get away with. Well, the stonemason collaborates with the nurse in the castle to go in and... you know, when the lord is away and kill the baby and the lady of the house. And indeed was a fairly vicious part of which nevertheless I respond to, because it's quite a politically interesting bit in this song. The stonemason, who's called Lambkin, gets fairly delicate about the fact that, you know, we're killing this noble lady, should we not have a basin to catch her blood? And the nurse says, we need nae basin, Lambkin, let it run through the flare. What better is the hert's blood o' the rich than o' the poor? And that is one of the few examples of that sort of, you know, class consciousness, rough and ready class consciousness that I can think of in folk music. And it's fairly violent. And also, there are nationalist folk songs. You know, there's no point. Although there is a fairly large repertoire of songs which display a resentment at war and at, you know, people being parted from their loved ones and things like that. Songs like High Germany, for example. Nevertheless, there are also songs, one springs to mind called Follow the Drum, which is just a celebration of, you know, these great soldiers who look so fine and gay, and, you know, they're going away to fight, and isn't it a grand thing to go and fight? Well, you know, so folk music isn't immune from this sort of thing either. And you can't really make too many general statements about it. Certainly not to the extent of saying it's either totally sad or totally happy. There are different aspects.
When talking about folk music, Sandra mentioned it before, that it relates to sex a great deal of the time. Most folk music is in fact very sexist, especially the ballads. They degrade women to positions where they can be owned. And it's the same thing follows through into modern pop music, where you've got pure sexist slander coming out over radios through modern pop musicians. And this is one thing that all music is very male orientated. I mean, for instance, can anybody think of a female classical composer? Can anybody think that there are a few female composers? Sorry.
Can we keep the questions to the speaker, please?
Those that there are, but they're very, very recent. And I just think, you know, you mentioned before that if we got together and started to produce our own folk music, pop music, then we can put forward the socialism. But there's a great problem in that there is really no identifiable strength of female music. It tends to be brushed aside by people talking about it all the time. There is plenty of female music around, music created by women, but it tends to be cast aside in these modern times.
Well, I think on one point, I won't exactly disagree with you, but I'll sort of take you up slightly on one point. Of course, there's a lot of sexism in folk music, but it's worth noting that quite often in folk songs, the women actually win. there are songs about men going out, and you know, that a man goes out and he sees a girl and he wants to have her, and she by guile and by using her head basically actually prevents him from doing what he wants. And these songs seem to be they've survived, and I think that although as I say there is sexism, and as you said that there is sexism in folk music, it's not an unremitting thing. And I think that possibly if research was done, we would find out a bit more about the women in relation to music. For example, it's interesting that in the area of politics as such, there has been uncovered literature of what you might call a feminist nature from the 16th and 17th centuries. It certainly existed. And it seems to me that even if you go through the folk songs, you do get songs sung in the voices of women and talking about life from their point of view, and often, of course, bewailing the fact that they are, for example, they've got married, and whereas before they were free to do all sorts of things, now they can't. And it's. I think that it's one of these areas which I'm sure more could be found out about. And I mean, that's really all I can say, I suppose, that the scholars should actually get down to doing it, and anybody who has pretensions to being a scholar should actually get down to combing through the stuff. Because a point worth making is that the way that folk music has been presented has often, not surprisingly, not been affected by the people presenting it. And indeed, a book by David Harker called Fake Song, which deals with the presentation of folk music to the public from the beginning of the 18th century to the present day, has some very interesting things to say in this respect. I've not actually read the book, but I've heard enough about it to know that whatever his conclusions might be, and whether or not I would agree with them all, he has, you know, it's a book worth reading. So if you wanted to have a read at that, I think it'll cost you £8.95. If so it's not cheap.
So interestingly, Sandy, I would have thought that the example that you gave of a woman winning was precisely an example of sexism in folk music, because it takes as its starting point the assumption that sex is something that women don't like, which is a male chauvinist point of view. And she has won by not having to give him what men like, as it were. And I would have thought that, moving this on to the point that Gary Slapper asked a question, which nobody has taken up, what music is going to be like in socialism, that you would expect women, the female character in songs about sex, to take a much more... aggressive, a much more positive approach to sex, and certainly an equal one to the attitude that men would take. I think there are other areas that would develop within song, but I'll stick with that one. And I think that is one positive development that would take place in music.
Well, I don't want to get too involved in a sort of argument about this one, but I think the point I was trying to make really wasn't. You see, you say that the starting point of the that example I gave is the women don't like sex. I don't think it's quite that, actually. The examples I'm thinking about, it's often a question of the woman not going with somebody that she doesn't want to go with, and also you do get folk songs written from a woman's point of view which do celebrate sex. You know, I can't actually give you off the cuff any examples, any extracts anyway, but they do exist. And whilst it's undoubtedly the case that I think most folk singers, the sexual songs they know tend to be from a male point of view, very much. Nevertheless, it's not an unremitting thing in the folk tradition, and indeed the fact that many of the singers that they collected songs from were women, I think, is part of what helps to explain the fact that some of these songs did survive. And I mean, I agree with you about the question of how that would be treated in music and in socialism, like an awful lot of other things. Equality would be the order of the day, and you know, everybody enjoying and taking delight in, if you like to put it that way, the various activities in life without any sort of silly prejudices about it, and exactly how that would manifest itself, what sort of diversity and what sort of common features would come out in the music would be the interesting thing to see. But you know, we could spend ages speculating about that, but we'll only know when we get there, after all.
I'm just going to add an example of some feminist, folk music example that comes to mind is Mandy Pryor sings a song on the Summer Solstice LP, which Tim Harper sings, called Sorry the Day I Was Married, which is quite an interesting song, and it ends up, the final verse in fact is basically giving advice to all other women never to bloody get married, but everyone else they do. So that could possibly be an example worth mentioning. I think the idea of these sort of sexist lyrics is perhaps one of the worst kinds of music for that. I would suggest it might be rock and roll rather than folk or pop. And there's a lot of all-female groups which have emerged, especially in the last few years. One of the reasons that they don't always last that long, and I can think of one or two examples of this, again, it's a telling point. One example would be Martha and the Vandellas, but there are others more recent. Good all women groups who broke up because one of them gets married and gets tied to the home in the way that they go along in the sort of society we're in. So that certainly happened many times, and has been the downfall of an all women group, whereas if it's men involved, there tends to be this tendency where they can, you know,
and obviously when they got married, it hasn't affected their economic activity as musicians.
You notice, of course, that a lot of them have very worthy things to say about how they're, you know, devoted to their families and all the rest. It doesn't stop them from assuming that they're going to be able to tour, you know, and the woman will stay at home, as it will. Of course, if it's a truly voluntary thing, fair enough. But then, of course, what do you call voluntary? I mean, given the values of our society, which still hold a lot of sway, although there is far more questioning of them now than there was, say, in my mother's time. My mother once said to me that when she was young, the saying went that when you got a man, you got a maester, as she put it. Well, she, I'm glad to say, never took that attitude. And I think that, you know, my mother and my father, there may have been silly prejudices about sex roles in our home, but there were... One never took the attitude that the other had to do what that person told them. Although, if anything, it was my mother who was the dominant character. if my mother wanted to make a decision about buying something for the house, my dad would just say, "Well, if you can afford it, you get it." Now, whether you call that the man lazily palming off the responsibility onto the woman, or whether it's just an example where my mother was more decisive than he was, then, you know, you can take two views about that, and I suppose either way it's still symptomatic of the society we're living in. But I mean, this, the point about all female groups is a good one. I mean, you know, why on earth do we not have, I think it was used to be a group called Fanny, did there not, an American group who produced, I wasn't somebody who would have gone out and listened to a lot of their music, but what I did hear, good heavy rock music, it wasn't bad. And it's a pity that groups like that don't often survive often enough, and it's more than a pity, in fact. It's something which perhaps a few determined socialist women might do something about, I don't know.
Right. Look at the back there, yes.
I just wanted to have a word about the sort of songs you suggested, whether Jack walked out on Midsummer Morning by the name of the song. I think that it's not so much about sex as about marriage as a property of a relationship, and about a woman keeping her virginity as a barber of this. There's one song I'm thinking of in which man goes out, has a brain with a girl. She then tricks him into marrying her because she thinks he's rich, and then finds out he isn't rich. So each of them is their comeuppance.
Well, that's a good point, I suppose, because I suppose you know, your virginity, if you were a woman in peasant society, at a certain stage, at any rate, your virginity was possibly the only thing you had to use as an item of property, as a bargaining counter. And, you know, the amount of courtship that seemed to have to go on in these songs, you know, however idealised it is and however stereotyped the forms of song became, nevertheless, you've got this the long drawn-out process that seemed to have to go on for a man and a woman to sort of get together. You know, with argument and counter-argument, question and answer and all this sort of carry on. And I think it might be worth adding a point here about a certain type of song in the folk tradition, songs which are known as broken token ballads. Now, these are certainly concerned with sex, but they're also concerned with something else. The broken token ballad would be, for example, where a fair maiden, if you like, would be walking out in the garden, and this sailor would come up to her and say, "I'll you know, give you wealth and happiness if you'll marry me." And she would say, "No, well, you see, my boyfriend is away at sea. And however long it takes, I'm going to stay loyal to him." And of course, it turns out that this guy is her boyfriend, because he produces the half of the ring that they broke between them when they went away. Now, these songs are very often sort of I know a good parody of this sort of song, or rather I know of it. I wish I could sing it to you because it's hilarious. But there was a serious point underlying this. If you worked on a sailing ship, you'd be away for years quite often, and you would become possibly unrecognisable by the time you got back, both because of the ravages of wind and weather, and also perhaps because of the horrible diseases you might pick up in one way or another, scurvy being only one of them, shall we just put it that way. And it would be necessary for some sort of institution to be adopted whereby, you know, the one party could recognise the other when they came back. Because the girl would presumably be more likely to be recognisable to the boy than the other way around. Now, of course, quite often these songs are phrased in very idealistic terms, but there's a strain of practicality running through it. And I think in all the sexual songs in folk music, there's a large element of what sometimes seems to be idealistic on the one hand or vicious on the other. There are just, you know, the practicalities of ordinary everyday life shine through in a lot of these songs.
Yes.
Yeah, I wondered what you thought would be commercial anti-war songs of the 60s.
I suppose you can't. I mean, it would be a bit sort of arrogant of me to dismiss them standing here, because some of them are pretty good in any case. I mean, in my own opinion, some of them are pretty good. I like one or two of Donovan's songs, for example. And I was always, when I was younger anyway, I always reckoned him more than Dylan, because I always thought he was actually a better musician. But, you know, some of his songs I would still listen to and enjoy. And I think that some of them, of course, are very idealistic. I mean, this is a point we can make over and over again, I think. There's one, the trouble is I can't remember the words exactly, but it's to the effect that this person has a dream that, you know, all the world leaders sat down and agreed to put an end to war, as if it was as easy as that. Well, of course, the trouble with that is that war is only one aspect of a sort of comprehensive problem, and indeed that's, I suppose, one of the faults of this type of song, is that it treats one problem and, you know, however many arguments you might raise for saying, oh, this is the most important problem, nevertheless, or this is a particularly horrifying problem that we have to face, you know, the prospect of nuclear annihilation, it is part of a bigger problem, of a bigger set of problems, and can only really be dealt with in company with them, ultimately. So, I mean, to answer your question, you know, I don't condemn them, I don't, you know, I'm not particularly in favour of it as a type of song, but there are good ones.
Does that music reflect, say, working class life in folk music and that sort of thing? But it all comes together with, like, music, dance and drinking that was celebrated, say, at the end of work or as a form of escapism. And more or less commercial, I would say, many years ago, like the music or the or drinking part, today it is more commercialised as a form of escapism. You know, is it possible that you could be brought to escapism away from music at all and drinking?
I don't really know quite how to answer this question, because I suppose the only answer is that if you can produce good commercial music that the record companies will be interested in for one reason or another, then it'll not matter, in a sense, the ideas that are being put forward. Now, this is a very sort of tricky area. Would socialist songs ever become... would they ever become commercially viable whilst still being, you know, properly socialist, if you like? Would you ever get a record company to promote a socialist record? Would it ever get to number one? Would the message be spread that way? I mean, this is a question to which you just kind of give an answer. And the point about music being related to work and the sort of pleasure activities like drinking, for example, well, I mean, that's a good point, because, you know, hard working as the peasants and industrial workers were. I suppose that they needed to, quite clearly, need to celebrate in some way, and we still do today, after all. I mean, you know, I remember when I worked in Croydon on a Friday night, my happiest moment was when I used to come out the bank I worked in and go down to the Dog and Bull pub in Surrey Street and drink about 6 pints of Young's Special. It was marvellous. Just standing there with all these people in the market, people in the pub, and then you'd get the other people that came in on a Friday. You'd get a quiet period between 8 and 9. Then it would liven up again about, you know, 8:15. It was great. And I mean, that was one of the greatest points of the week. And then I'd go for an Indian meal afterwards, of course. Assuming that you were still able to appreciate it. You know, this is a phenomenon which exists into the present day, and people, I suppose, are still singing songs about that sort of thing, even although commercial music tends to deal in escapism. But, you know, it's a challenge, perhaps. Maybe some of you think that it's an impossible challenge to meet, but it might be one worth taking up, that, you know, try and write a song that HMV will actually want to promote and sell, or whatever, any of these other record companies, and see how it goes. I think that's all you can say about it, really.
I'm just wondering about there seems to be a fairly recent, particular interest in pop music that came from the 50s and early 60s. That seems to be a particular tension at the moment. I just wonder if there might be any particular expectation as well.
Maybe because pop music has run out of steam a bit, I don't know. I mean, I used to listen to Radio 1 for about a year in 1981. I would listen to it just about every day in the evening. Now, I don't now, so I'm not as in touch with pop music, and the same goes for Capital Radio and stations like that as well. I'm not as in touch with what goes on in the pop music world as I might have been at one time. But, you know, possibly... You see, there've been sort of great times in pop music. There's been like the Beatles, the Mersey sound, and all that sort of thing. And there was Elvis and all that before that. There was the Beatles, and then there was there was protest songs. Then the 70s, you had punk, which was supposed, according to one description I heard, to have brought politics into pop music. Well, I don't know that it entirely did that, but. A fairly nihilistic sort of politics often, but you've not got anything like that just at the moment. I mean, what you have now, it seems to me, are particular individuals like Madonna, for example. Now, you know, does that typify pop music these days? I mean, does that sort of exemplify the essence of it? People like Madonna or what's her name, Samantha Fox. That's a good point to mention there. That really, I suppose, has been the most political thing that you've got in these days. Now, I don't want to get involved in the argument about how worthwhile the Band-Aid thing is. I mean, clearly, once again, it's attempting to tackle one problem, and indeed only one aspect of one problem. And it is doing it in a sort of very moralistic way, so much as to say that if you don't support them, you know, if you don't actually put money in the box, then you can't really be interested in feeding the starving. I think I have a lot of sort of emotional sympathy, if you like, for Geldof at times, anyway. And he's rather impatient, you know, attempts to get on with it, but he does, or him and his cohorts, as it were, do in the process rather ignore the fact that some people have been trying to deal with these problems for quite a while, and of course within the context of the society we live in, they've been just as unable to do it as what he will find. They've found it just as difficult as what he will find it, whatever sort of partial successes he may have. Now, frankly, I don't like the Band-Aid records very much as music. And I'm sorry to say that if you're going to promote a cause through me, I mean, I might be an exception, of course. I think a lot of people have bought these records, quite clearly they have, and they did like them, or they felt, you know, that the cause was worthwhile enough to buy them. I don't really like them, I have to say that. And I think if you're going to put forward a message in music, you've got to attend to the music as well as the message, you know. Obviously this is a very subjective thing, and it's something which will vary from individual to individual and from group to group, but it's got to be attended to. And to come to your question, which I think we've rather tended to leave behind a bit, the music of the 60s, I think, possibly for a lot of people symbolises something better than they've got now. As I say, that pop music has possibly, to a large extent, run out of steam. And you're not getting the same, quite the same factors at work in promoting a sort of new and self-confident music. I mean, we've had all that to some extent, and perhaps it's a question of will there be, you know, another revival of creativity and self-confidence in music? Well, I mean, that's a question which we'll have to wait to find the answer to.
Right, so one last question, right at the back.
Well, I think basically what Sandy said, I'll be repeating, but it is true that pop music gets to such a point where the market's saturated, and at the moment we have a harking back to jazz and Latin, and basically because the finding within pop music, you just reach the dead end, and it's like a sort of point where you sort of regroup before you sort of find some other pop phenomenon. But pop music harks back time and time again. I mean, it's still with reggae, jazz, and Latin, folk. I mean, we'll continually keep doing it.
I think the trouble with this business of, you know, the sort of where do we go from here question that keeps coming up. I mean, it comes up in the folk world as well. People maybe get a bit self-conscious about it. You see, the likes of I don't know if the names will mean very much to you, but the likes of Ashley Hutchings, who, for example, was a founder member of both Fairport Convention and Steel Eye Span, who, after all, did have a number one, I believe, Steel Eye Span, did they not? The likes of him, these people have, I think, gone into a lot of these areas with the view of, you know, how can we broaden the field of folk music? And it gets to be a bit self-conscious at a point. So far as I'm concerned, to hear rocked-up folk songs is just normal to me now. And I think that if people were less self-conscious about it, perhaps, and just, you know, obviously you can't be totally unconscious of the kind of influences that you're drawing upon or using, but, you know, a more total view of music. I don't know. It's a question which you know, we could talk about forever, and perhaps. Perhaps after we've left here, we'll go on talking about it. I don't know, but as I say, it's up to socialists. I think I'll end on this point. Really, it's up to socialists, all of us who have any pretensions to being artists of any kind, or who are even a bit pretentious. Any of us who have any claims to being artistic in any degree should really get on and do it, I suppose, and without preaching about it, because you know, it includes everybody in this room who has ever had anything to do with music or who thinks they're good at it in any degree. We should go on and do it and write the songs, and let's hope that, having said that, by the time we have our next education conference, perhaps we'll have a few songs, new songs to sing at the social, I don't know. Yeah.